Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by Glen Coco. Aw, you're sponsoring episodes now? Good for you, Glen Coco. You go, Glen Coco. And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome, MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex. James will be joining me shortly. Here is part two of our discussion of John Hughes movies and teen movies from the 80s. Enjoy.
Well, speaking of endearing stalkers...
Yeah.
Pretty in Pink.
Yeah.
With Ducky.
Ducky.
Well, it's the plot of Pretty in Pink.
Andy, played again by Molly Ringwald, is from, she's poor. And...
working class.
No,
she's poor.
Yeah. Her dad is unemployed for the most part. And her mom has left the family, I think years ago. Yeah. And, and she seems to be in love with this guy, Blaine, who is a... What are you laughing? Because it's not a name. It's a major appliance.
Oh, it's what? What's a Blaine?
That's a joke.
Oh,
Ducky makes.
Right. No, it's just like, what's the most expensive name we can think of?
I know.
Anyway.
Her best friend Ducky is in love with her, and prom's coming up. What's gonna happen?
Yeah. Yeah, so she's kind of the working class one. Blaine, super rich.
Yes.
Ducky...
If you couldn't tell by the name Blaine.
Yeah. Ducky, I guess we're supposed to take as, maybe not as poor, but certainly not rich. He's from the same side of the tracks as...
I think it's generally implied in everything that I've read about it since that, that Ducky is sort of taken as poor.
Yeah, and they've kind of... Ducky and Andy have been kind of best friends for a long time.
Yep.
It's quite clear that... Ducky wants to get some.
It's quite clear that Ducky is in love with Andy. Yes,
and Andy really loves him, but isn't in love with him, I guess you could say.
Yeah, yeah,
just
absolutely.
Super, super close, platonic friends.
Yes.
And she doesn't want it to go anywhere else. And you forgot the other attraction going on. Spade Man.
Spade Man and everybody watching the movie?
No. James Spader, who plays
Steph
and his girlfriend Benny. Steph really wants, I was going to say it sensitively, but I don't think there's any sensitive about it. He wants to
bang Andy.
Yeah, he wants to bang Andy.
Yeah.
That's true. And he's another Richie. He's a term that they use, Richie.
Yeah.
He's friends with Blaine. And prom's coming up, and it's basically kind of Andy trying to get Blaine and trying to get to go to prom together and have a magical evening, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I guess we might as well talk about the ending, I guess.
Don't want to talk about the...
Well, I mean, okay. Let's continue.
Well, I guess, yeah, it pretty much is the ending. I mean, they go back and forth for a little while. Andy finally gets a chance to go with Blaine. They go to a party together with all of Blaine's rich friends including Steph and Benny and other drunk rich people
and we
white
get
pants.
Some of the greatest James Spader the world has ever seen. When he's lying on the bed, like with his shirt unbuttoned, holding a scotch and shrugging.
There are several scenes where he is wearing an unbuttoned shirt.
Oh my God,
it is
amazing.
Phenomenal.
Also, yeah.
And so they leave the party when everyone's really mean to Andy, calling her a mutant and that she's poor, so she shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
They leave, they decide to go to. The kind of the local new wave punker metalhead club.
Yes. sure.
So they go there. Ducky's there with Andy's mentor / boss, Iona.
Yep. Played by the incomparable Annie Potts.
Yes. And so this is after kind of Ducky has kind of made a run at Andy. She says no. He kind of says some terrible shit about Blaine, but she goes off with him anyway. So now they kind of... bump into each other again. Some ugliness there. Kind of after the whole party experience, Blaine's a little uncertain that they're going to work out.
Yes.
And after having asked her to prom, backs out.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's after kind of the Steph gives him a little speech about, oh, I don't know, man, this is stupid. You shouldn't do this. She's poor and all that stuff.
She's a mutant.
Yeah.
Unbutton my shirt.
I'm bored with this conversation. I'm walking out. That's actually how that scene ends.
I love that. Yeah, and then, Blaine, after all this, Blaine and Steph kind of get into a fight. Blaine decides to go off to prom alone.
Mm-hmm.
Andy goes to prom alone to prove that they didn't break her.
Yeah.
When she gets there, Ducky's there alone. They hold hands and get close, never really kiss.
Mm-hmm.
And we're supposed to be amazed that Blaine showed up by himself, yeah. I guess.
Yeah, no, the ending doesn't work, but he shows up and Ducky's like, go, or whatever.
Yeah, you know, well, like, you know, Blaine makes the speech who's about like, oh, you know, Andy, like, it wasn't you, it was me. Like, I didn't think I was brave enough to deal with this, yeah. even though I know you could. Ducky, you know, just wanting the best for Andy, I guess is the way the story goes, says, you know, go with him, you know, you guys are right for each other. Yeah. And then Ducky finds some girl.
Christy Swanson
in like 30 seconds. Yeah. And happily ever after for everybody, right?
Yeah, and Andy and Blaine make out in the parking lot, basically.
Yeah.
And that's the end of the movie. Fades to black. Yeah, the original ending was that... and the original ending they shot is that Andy and Ducky end up together. Which didn't work out too well with test audiences. And so it was reshot. And it's very clearly reshot when you see the shadow between Andrew McCarthy's wig and his head. Like, it is the worst wig. There is a noticeable shadow.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Well, he lost a bunch of weight in the meantime for another role.
Yeah, he was playing, like, a Vietnam vet or something like that. And, oh, my God, it's so funny. His wig kills me.
He looks like the most actor-y actor I've ever seen.
Andrew McCarthy?
Yeah. I don't know. It's not even that he's necessarily that good looking. I just find he has like a very actor-y face.
Yeah, that's fair. I think he's got sort of like he's got a real boyish face, and that's still the case. You know,
yeah,
like
that's probably part of it.
If you see him now, you'd still like, you know, he's like one of those 40-year-olds that sort of looks like they never really grew up.
Right. Know? Like Alan Ruck.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
We'll get to later. Yeah. So what was it didn't test well.
Yeah, test audiences didn't like that Andy and Blaine couldn't end up together.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, as somebody who is more of a Ducky than a Blaine, for a long time, I always hated the ending of this movie. But the point that some filmmakers made was that the problem is that, and I don't necessarily agree with this point because, you know, anyways. But the point was that John Cryer, the actor playing Ducky, wasn't sexy enough for Andy to go with him. And that is the filmmaker's reasoning for it, for why it didn't work. I think the whole point is that, you know, she's going for love, not any sort of sexiness. So I think that's kind of unfortunate that anybody would say that about this movie. But and it kind of undermines the whole thing. But yeah, I really see no reason why they couldn't have ended up together. When they did shoot the original ending, and I haven't seen the original ending. I don't know if it exists, but Molly Ringwald was apparently extremely ill and fainted on set that day, and so they never really got a good take of it. I would say. So there's also that going against it. I mean, in Ducky's defense, and John Cryer, who is awesome in this movie.
Yeah, he's good. The Otis Redding performance.
Oh my God. Like, I have a note that I want to talk about that.
I did not see that coming at all, and I was very pleased.
Yeah, no, okay, let's just talk about that now. It's so good.
Okay, wait. I have one other thing to say about that ending, though.
Okay, we'll get back to it, because we're talking about the dance now. I watched it 5 times last night, just because, like, I just love it. It's so good.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, it's a good song and all that, and but he just owns it, like, everything.
It's hard to describe how they do this well. All he does is kind of lip sync to an Otis Redding song in Trax, which is the record shop that Andy works at. And he just sings along, dances a little bit, runs around. But yeah,
so
like the characters are stunned, and usually sometimes when they try that thing where the characters are like in awe of something and it doesn't work with you, it just feels like a really awkward waste of 3 minutes. But this one absolutely crushed
me. It's just such a great sequence, and it's all in the close ups of him after he gets behind the rack of vinyl, and then he sort of stands up and he's like sort of pleading towards Andy. It's all in those close ups. Those close ups just make the whole thing. But anyways, it's a great dance. So, I don't see why they couldn't have ended up together, and it's unfortunate that they didn't, and John Hughes actually doesn't like that it ended that way.
To the point that
that he made Some Kind of Wonderful and basically reversed the ending. Some Kind of Wonderful is very much Pretty in Pink.
Genders reversed.
Yes. Genders reversed, and
it's like a rich poor love triangle, and then the poor kid goes with
Keith ends up with Watts, and Keith is Andy and Watts is Ducky. So.
Okay. So my understanding of one of the reasons why the original ending didn't work is that it kind of solidified one thing that the rest of the movie kind of argues against, which is that poor people and rich people can get together. Mm-hmm. And the argument is that by having Andy end up with Ducky, the message seems to be that it doesn't matter how much you like someone or how well you get along or how great these people are. You have to stay in kind of like your socioeconomic rung. Yep. So the poor people end up with the poor people and the rich people end up with the rich people, no matter how the emotional thing works out. Mm-hmm. I mean, I see that. It is tough because it's kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of thing. But, you know, we could just be reading too much into the class struggle of the movie with that.
Well,
but
I think the movie is about class struggle, yeah, but the point and the ending of the movie is Andy finding love. The point is not her necessarily defeating her class structure. It's that if she's constantly aspiring to be with a rich person, right, like, does that necessarily make it better, you know? Like,
yeah.
I recognize it's tricky, and whichever way they went with could read it negatively the other way, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's just that Ducky so clearly actually loves her. It's not clear that Blaine does, you know, like Blaine
yeah.
doesn't do anything, you know?
Well, he pulls some dick moves. Like, but really the two big things that we're supposed to see as his redemption is that he came to prom alone. Okay. Not a big deal. Get over it. And when he says, like, where he kind of takes the blame for them not working out and says that he was a coward and that she was doing the right thing, mm-hmm. which is a nice thing to do.
Yeah.
But still, it does not compare to the...
It's like there's nothing on their date that I see that it's like, oh, I'd want to go on a second date.
It's
yeah.
kind of a funny dude, but yeah, nothing where it's like, this is a great guy for you to end up with. You're right. Anything else on Pretty in Pink?
Yeah, I kind of like... I like the first half hour of this movie quite a bit. I think it's pretty good. And I really like Harry Dean Stanton's character, who plays Andy's father. Andy and her dad have a pretty good scene towards the end where it becomes clear just how insecure her dad is. And I don't think you see a lot of characters like that that are just sort of broken by this this woman leaving them, their family. And like, it really is a hindrance to his life. And it's clear, like, he's just a broken man because of it. And I think his character is really interesting because of that. And I think it's something that I see in this movie that I really haven't seen in a lot of other movies, or haven't seen it memorably, I guess. But yeah, I really like him. And there are some really nice shots in this movie, like the shot where Blaine and Andy are standing in front of the headlights of his car. That's a really nice shot. When Ducky's sitting in the rain on like that newspaper thing with that giant mural behind him.
Yeah.
It's a good looking movie. And I mean, it's shot by Tak Fujimoto, who would then shoot Ferris Bueller. Yeah, and I guess the only other thing is that this movie, Pretty in Pink, is not directed by John Hughes. Everybody calls it a John Hughes movie. We probably just did, you know,
yeah.
Because it's widely sort of accepted as a movie that is a John Hughes movie. Howard Dutch or Deutch, I don't know how to pronounce it. It was the director, but he very much credits John Hughes. And I mean, he was one of Hughes's friends until Hughes's death. Like, he was one of the few people from Hollywood that Hughes would still talk to after he sort of went on a self-imposed exile. And I mean, as a friend would, he gives all the credit to the Hughes because people sort of see it as his movie. And I mean, given that Dutch hasn't had a great career post Hughes, I think sort of backs up the statement that everybody thinks it is a Hughes movie. And I'm just trying to think of other times where this happens. Like, I know, you know, Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi. Those are the two ones I always think of.
Movies people think are directed by someone
yeah,
that aren't.
And yeah. Pretty in Pink and Some Kind of Wonderful. But I just couldn't come up with anything else, really.
Yeah, I was trying to think. I mean, the one thing is kind of the Apatow ones, where maybe people miss one of those. But he's usually produced it, and he's usually associated with it, and it's usually people he's worked with before. And that is one of the things about Pretty in Pink.
That's Hughes, though, too, right?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Like, what is this movie if, you know, 16 Candles and Breakfast Club wasn't made? Probably would have been way less successful. Molly Ringwald probably wouldn't have been in it. you know, all these things. And it just kind of had that cachet of being a Hughes movie.
Yep.
Because he wrote it, and it's, you know, it fits in with a lot of the themes that he worked with over the last 2 years, and it's got some of the actors that he likes. But yeah, I was also trying to think of that. Where does this kind
I think Apatow is a great example.
Yeah, I think Apatow is probably the best of, you get this kind of dynasty almost of movie making, and then so much gets attached to it that, you know, one movie that's just kind of close enough just gets thrown into the mix because, you know, of those things I just listed.
Yeah. Apatow is a great point.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's also telling that Apatow is a huge fan of John Hughes. So
yeah. And actually I have something to say about that later, but it's quite clear that he was an influence. And I mean, it's just, these movies are just so influential. Like, for considering, if we're just going to talk about these four movies, one of which you didn't even direct, like, the impact that these four movies had on teen movies, on high school movies, on movies, on music, like, it made a lot of sense to me after watching all these and doing all this research why people made such a big deal when John Hughes died. Because as I said, I didn't watch these movies other than Ferris Bueller until just this year. So when he died in 2009, I knew his name and I knew what movies he's attached to. And I knew that he meant a lot to a lot of people. But yeah, just doing the research for this just drove home what an inspiration he was to so many people.
Yeah, he's been called, I forget who called him this, but he's the Jean-Luc Godard of teen cinema. And
seems absolutely appropriate.
And has also been called one of the most influential American filmmakers, which I don't remember what the cutoff was, but, you know, probably like post-1980, which I think is absolutely true.
Oh, post-1980, definitely. Yeah.
And I think you can make an argument for, you know.
Yeah, I know. I saw someone call him, like, I think top three post-war influential directors, which
I could see that.
Yeah. Anyway, Bueller.
Nice.
Get it?
Yeah. No,
like
I got
the
it.
Movie.
Good segue.
So most importantly, this movie, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, brought us Ben Stein's acting career.
Yeah.
first and foremost.
Yeah. So thank you.
In conclusion, no.
So now we all know. Now we know we all wear masks and a variety of other catchy lines.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off, written and directed by John Hughes.
Yes.
Yes. Starring Matthew Broderick. Again, this is the movie that I had seen a lot when I was a kid and just growing up in general. And I really thought this was going to be the least interesting movie to talk about. As much as I like this movie, I didn't think I'd have that much to say about it, but there is actually a lot there.
Oh, there's tons. I mean, when we were emailing back and forth about, what we were going to talk about for Ferris, it was sort of, I hadn't rewatched it, but I hadn't seen it since high school, but my theory on it in high school was always that it's underrated, even though it's well liked.
Very well liked.
Because, you know, not a whole lot of people take it like as a serious movie because it's just so fun, you know? Like,
yeah.
It's just one of the most fun movies, and Matthew Broderick's performance is so goddamn fun and good. And I don't know, it's just sort of nobody really looks at it as a serious movie, and I think it kind of should be because
yeah.
Well, although the Alan Ruck character Cameron, people tend to look that seriously.
Yeah, and that's yeah. We'll get to that. That's weird to me. But anyway, yeah, you're absolutely right. I think this movie is more fun than it is funny. There are definitely some good laughs, but I find it more of like a fun time than like a hilarious, like can't catch my breath kind of sides-hurting laughing.
Yeah, okay.
Movie.
Those happen constantly, right? Those sides-hurting movies.
Yeah. It's kind of like Breakfast Club. Do you want to go over the plot of this one? Ferris has a day off.
He basically calls in sick. Not calls in sick, but he takes a sick day, essentially, and fools his parents into actually thinking he's sick, and then gets his best friend Cameron to come over, and then they go pick up his girlfriend, or Ferris's girlfriend, Sloane, from high school, under the guise that her grandmother has died.
Yes.
And they go to Chicago. They take Cameron's father's prized possession, his Ferrari of some sort, and take it to Chicago and sort of see the town. They go to an art gallery, the Sears Tower, is that the tall place that they're at?
Yes, yeah. That'd be Sears Tower.
And, you know, they go to a fancy restaurant, Shakey.
Shakey, sorry.
like the Shakey's pizza chain.
Yeah,
and then there's the parade.
Yep.
And then, you know, then mad dash home to make it home before the parents get there.
Yeah. And then there's Principal Rooney.
Rooney!
Principal Rooney is doing his best to catch Ferris Bueller. He's got 9 absences in the semester, and he's sure Ferris Bueller, you know, is just faking sick. All the students kind of rally behind Ferris, and this really seems to get Rooney's goat, as it were.
Yeah.
And, yeah, he kind of makes it a personal vendetta. And then there's this the plot with the sister, which I think people kind of forget.
Yeah, no, I like her a lot.
I think it's really good. She kind of is mad at Ferris at first, doesn't know why she has to go to school if he doesn't, is mad at the parents for falling for his bullshit.
It's textbook older sibling, younger sibling. Like, the older sibling always just sort of being bitter at all the things that the younger kid got that they never did.
Yeah.
So it's that.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah. And then she gets caught, goes to jail, meets Charlie Sheen, comes back home, and in the end...
No, she doesn't, like, what is she doesn't get caught. She's like, she calls the cops when Rooney's in her house, and she goes down to the station to give a statement. Like, there's
yeah,
a intruder in her house.
But then they catch her, they say that it was a fake call.
Oh, okay,
something
fair
I totally
enough,
forgot,
Rooney
too.
Rooney disappeared, yeah.
Yeah, and she speeds, trying to beat Ferris home, too, but yeah, that's a different thing. Yeah, and then kind of in the end, really... she lets Ferris kind of get away with everything and kind of saves him when Rooney has ostensibly kind of caught up to him and ended it all. Yeah, and I guess, yeah, Cameron needs to be talked about. Sloane is pretty useless in this movie.
I disagree. We'll talk about
really?
It later.
Okay.
You know, Cameron, his dad hates him. You know, like,
Cameron's,
I don't have a whole lot to say.
Cameron's dad hates him. His best friend is kind of like the most popular outgoing guy, whereas Cameron is this, like, really... neurotic, obsessed, like constantly thinking he's sick when he's not, is I think you're supposed to take from a lot of the stuff. And he's kind of going psycho through the whole movie, is he not? He's, well, maybe not going psycho, but he's going through some very serious emotional stuff right here.
Yeah, no, he needs therapy probably.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of Hughes movies are, you know, they're definitely dramas with elements of comedy. And this movie really is very heavy comedy, you know, it's... not heavy, but I mean very strong on the comedy. You know, it's just a guy goofing around and fooling people and getting the better of his principal and all this kind of stuff. And he's kind of this fun-loving, freewheeling guy. And then there's the subplot where his friend is terribly depressed.
Yes.
Yeah, he feels he needs to confront his dad. You know, at one point he jumps down into the pool and it seems like either... A suicide attempt, or at least a cry for help, maybe. No?
He's just seeing if he could get Ferris at that point, and they talk about it afterwards.
Yeah, well...
He's like, I want to see if I can make you sweat. He does.
Still, that doesn't mean that's necessarily the true case.
That's true.
Okay. And the scene, everyone... You want to talk about the museum scene? People seem to like that one.
I love the museum scene. And yeah. This is kind of like what I was saying. This movie's gorgeous. The cinematography is awesome. There's so much symmetry in the shots, and there are a lot of shots of the camera in front of the characters, and the characters are just looking right above them, right above the camera, and just like perfectly centered and stuff like that. And a really pretty movie, and I actually think that indie movie Ferris Bueller trailer really helped a lot of other people see that. Like, I've had conversations since that trailer came out when it had that like music and sort of picked all the best shots from the movie, put them all together. And people now sort of recognize Ferris Bueller as a pretty movie. Like, I remember when that trailer, that, you know, fake trailer, which we'll post on the website, came out. I would talk to people about that trailer, and then we'd lead into talking about the movie, and then I'd be like, yeah, and it's a really beautiful movie. And they're like, yeah, yeah, I never realized that until
the
trailer.
Trailer.
Yeah. And, but it is a very gorgeous movie. Particularly the symmetry and stuff like that is what I like, but the art art gallery sequence is really pretty, and I love the shots back and forth between Cameron and the girl in the painting.
Yeah,
they're spectacular.
What do you like about it?
I don't know, I just sort of love that it's like I don't know, it's sort of just getting as deep into something as you can. I don't know, there's nothing really I can say that I like about it.
Okay.
I just enjoy it
because it's they go to the art museum in Chicago, and there's a very big, like, massive painting. I forget the name of it. It's some French painter who I probably should have remembered anyway. But it's done in, like, a pointillist style, so it's a lot of, like, really small dots. It's kind of like early comic books, where it's a bunch of little dots of different colors. When you get up really closely to it, you kind of don't even know what you're looking at. And, you know, it just seems like maybe... I always just saw it as maybe Cameron kind of looking at himself in this little girl, and as he kind of examines himself more and more, he doesn't even see anything there. Like, there's a person if you look at it from a distance, but when you get really close, there's nothing there. There's little, you know, blobs of color and some, you know, vague sense of meaning and, you know, some small things, but when you get really close to it, there's nothing actually substantial there. And I think that works with Cameron, who fails to really kind of make an identity of himself for the entire movie until maybe he feels like he needs to stand up to his dad by the end. And that seems like the start of something for him. But I think he's just very concerned. And I find that scene of him looking more at himself and not seeing who he wants to see and not really seeing a real person at all.
Yeah, I see that. But again, I sort of take the Cameron's last scene or the, you know, his scene as him sort of being like, yeah, this is the start of something.
Yeah.
And yeah, the art gallery scene obviously happens before that. And so, yeah, maybe it's sort of like he's seeing nothing. And then eventually he sort of gets to this point where he wants to make a change, you know?
Yeah.
So
they almost cut that scene, eh?
The art gallery scene?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Because in the original, the way that they had it structured before, the parade became before it. And then the last thing they do with their freedom is go and look at it. All this art.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's kind of they tried to make that the climax of the movie, and as good as a scene it is, I don't think it functions that well as a climax. And the parade scene, just because it's the biggest and the most spectacular, kind of makes a better turning point.
Yeah. The cast, when they saw the first cut of the movie, just hated it. They're like, it was terrible, and producers were freaking out and stuff like that. And so John Hughes, an editor, went and recut it and made this, so
which everyone loves now. Yeah. Do you see this movie kind of as like almost like the way that comic books were for people? Like, it's kind of like a power fantasy. Like, you know, if I could be Ferris Bueller, if I could be this smooth, if I could fool everybody, if no one could ever get the best of me. Like, he kind of is a very unreasonable, unrealistic, like amazingly awesome person to be, right? Like, he seems to have everything collected. He's got, he seems to be smart enough. He seems very popular. He's got a girlfriend. He's got a best friend. Comes from a good family, and he just, you know, fools them to get anything he wants. Do you see that at all?
Yes, absolutely. Like I said, with probably Pretty in Pink and 16 Candles, they're like wish fulfillment movies, and this is like the ultimate wish fulfillment movie.
Yeah.
You know, you get to do everything you want to do.
Okay, yeah, I saw someone call this the moviest movie ever made.
Okay,
and I was like, okay, I don't really know what that means, but the argument was that it's purely about escapism. Like, it is which a lot of people say is the function of movies and why people like going to movies. Like, even within this movie, which is an already escape from your life, it's just about some guy escaping his life and his responsibilities and just taking a whole day off to do what he wants to do. You know, gets his best friend, his girlfriend, and an awesome car, and goes to a baseball game, and, you know, eats at a fancy restaurant. And, you know, it's just, even for an escapist medium, this is the most escapist thing there is.
Yeah, and was listening to Jason Reitman. I don't know how you're supposed to pronounce
that. I say Reitman.
Yeah, I know. I always hear Reitman, though. I don't know which way. Anyways, Jason, Jason R., son of Ivan R., director of Ghostbusters, said that Ferris Bueller's just like he loves it. He thinks it's like a perfect movie and that it's just sort of like pure joy in a film. And I think that's correct.
Yeah.
Correct statement.
Actually, I saw a list of people who have called this their favorite movie. Pretty awesome lineup. Like, yeah. Justin Timberlake, Wolf Blitzer, Dan Quayle, like just this wide variety of people. Simon Cowell, who, you know, British, but still. Yeah, it really, British people don't understand. it just seems like, you know, this is that movie for so many people and kind of probably gave birth to Zach Morris of Saved by the Bell.
Oh, unquestionably.
Yeah. Hmm. Despite Ferris Bueller having his own show for a little bit.
Yeah. We won't talk about that.
Okay.
We don't want to upset Jennifer if she's listening.
Okay. I know one other change that they made to the movie, kind of to finance Ferris's whole day off, he was going to steal a bond from his father and then go to the bank and sell it. But they thought this would make him look like a thief instead of a lovable rogue, which is what he is. And I mean, how good is Ferris Bueller? Like, how nice is he? Is he a lovable rogue? He's clearly a rogue. and people seem to love him, but I mean, he doesn't treat Cameron that well. He lies to his parents. He doesn't hurt them or anything, but he kind of pressures his friend who feels he's sick. I mean, is he being nice to Cameron by knowing him so well that he knows Cameron's just lying to himself and he should really come out and enjoy the world, or is he just pressuring him for his own means? I mean, he steals his dad's car.
Yeah. And you can make an argument either way. I think that Cameron at the end says, I had a great time today. It kind of justifies right. that Ferris is doing something good. But yes, I see the point where he is a rascal, if you will. But he's so likable. Come on.
Is this the least 80s movie of the ones we talked about?
Of the ones we talked about, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, tons of people love this movie now. Like, it's pretty ridiculous.
Have you met somebody that doesn't?
I have, but okay. few and far between.
Yeah, exactly.
And people usually don't just like it, but, like, love it.
Yeah.
And it's one of those movies I find people rewatch a lot, even more than most movies.
Exceptionally entertaining.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's, again, tons of fun. Have you noticed that people who watch it, maybe like people younger than us who watch it now for the first time, don't seem to like it as much? Do you find it still holds up just as well?
Oh yeah, definitely. And I was just watching clips of people talking about Ferris Bueller, or I was watching a documentary on Hughes movies in general, and they interview a lot of kids, and like high school kids, and it's like, what is your favorite of these movies? And like people would talk about other movies, like what did you like about The Breakfast Club and all that, and then when people talk about Ferris Bueller, they just like light up. Like this is a movie that's going to last for sure.
Yeah. I can see that.
As far as like being just as well liked as it always has been.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah. That being said, not everybody does love it. I read some kind of negative reviews about when it came out, and someone took a pretty, kind of a really political angle to it and said like, this is the worst thing about America right now. Like this is, kind of celebrating this like Reaganist approach of immediate gratification, of like kind of just hedonistic pleasures, of doing everything in the moment and not planning ahead or really considering the people around you's feelings. You know, it's all just about being self-indulgent. He, you know, arguably abuses his friends, but even without that, a lot of people, you know, felt that this was kind of a celebration of like a generation of people in the 80s who were slackers but greedy at the same time, who wanted everything but didn't want to work for it.
Yep.
How do you feel about that?
I think it's there, but still like the movie.
But it's too much fun. Yeah. Okay.
I'm a slacker who wants everything but doesn't want to work for it. You know, why would I not want it?
Like true. So you're okay with Cameron's mental health for the most part?
Yeah, I think.
Okay. Have you heard the Fight Club-esque theory about this movie?
I'm sure I have, but I do not remember it. So okay. Detail.
Okay. So the theory is that, Cameron, and I mean, it varies a little bit from person to person, but I think the common one is that Ferris and maybe even Sloane don't exist at all. That they're figments of Cameron's, no good.
It's so stupid.
Figments of Cameron's imagination.
It's so absurd.
Well, there is some ridiculous stuff that happens in this movie that needs explanation, right?
Well, fourth wall breaking constantly.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a movie, so I understand it's not going to be entirely realistic. But the theory is that Cameron is this like quiet, reserved, nervous, not confident guy who doesn't have luck with, you know, friends or family or girls. Mm. And what he did is he kind of imagined Ferris to try to, you know, to try to become Ferris. Ferris is someone who's loved by his parents, loved by the entire school, you know, getting away with, you know, decent enough grades while skipping a lot of class. And that, you know, this character is actually just someone that Cameron created to try, you know, to live vicariously through somebody who he made up to try to experience these things for the first time because he, you know, clearly has such problems with his family and, you know, his social life and things like that. This does some things like explain why the whole town is behind Ferris, while they've painted Save Ferris on a water tower when he was sick for a day. You know, why the whole town is trying to collect money for him, how the cops even know he's sick. And also the parade thing, which is, you know, I know it's a movie, but still kind of unreasonable that he got this parade, got up on the float and was singing for everybody and drew all his attention and never gets in trouble with anybody. He fools a bunch of people and just gets away with it, you know, at the restaurant, the car, everything, right? And Cameron is mentally unhealthy. I think you could argue to what degree, but, you know, you can see the pool thing is maybe a cry for help. If you watch that scene where he gets in the car for the first time and is deciding whether or not to go visit Ferris, which is a funny scene, if you look at it through that lens, it's actually a very kind of disturbing scene where he kind of seems to be wrestling with some inner demons. And, yeah, I mean, it's not the truth. I mean, it's not like Fight Club where you find out that is the definitive vision of the movie. But I think it is an interesting fan theory, and that when you have that in mind and you watch the movie again, you can see some things that really, really line up with it.
No, I think you can see things line up with it. And as somebody who has been known to come up with ridiculous things about movies, that's fine. You know, that's not going to change how I watch the movie.
Okay, that's fine. There was a lot of options for they were considering for Ferris Bueller to play him.
I read they always wanted Matthew Broderick, though.
Okay. I think John Hughes said that he did have that, and then he did have him in mind. And then they kind of said, like, look, but if he doesn't want to do it, we should at least have some people lined up.
Because Broderick was resistant to doing it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, with a gap like that, when a movie's trying to be made, it would obviously be expensive for the studio. So they tried to line up some other people to play him, including Rob Lowe. Should make a lot of sense with the Brad Pack thing. Think you'd make a good Ferris?
Probably. I don't know. And like, certainly the Rob Lowe we know now, like if he could go back to the Rob Lowe then.
The Parks and Rec Rob Lowe.
Yeah, like he's a very talented comedian now. I didn't see a lot of him in the 80s, so I don't know.
Maybe it'd just be more sax. John Cusack? Again, same thing, Brad Pack, like around.
He doesn't seem happy enough for me. Like, John Cusack, I just look at him and I just think he looks depressed all the time.
Okay.
So I feel like that would be a big problem.
Yeah, and that is quintessential to the Ferris identity, that he's, like, totally fun-loving and carefree, right? Mm. Yeah. Johnny Depp, same thing, maybe?
Again, I haven't seen enough of him in the 80s to really know.
Tom Cruise?
I think Tom Cruise could have done it.
I think it would have been funny. And, that scene from, like, Risky Business, it seems like it could be put right in to Ferris Bueller's Day Off without missing a beat.
Oh, I certainly got the charisma necessary.
Yeah. Robert Downey Jr.?
Again, not seen a lot in the 80s, but never count out Robert Downey Jr. I'm sure he could have done it.
And this one I like. Michael J. Fox?
Yeah, he probably could have done it. Yeah.
Okay.
Anthony Michael Hall was offered it as well.
Yeah, it was Anthony Michael Hall as... I thought there was one where the idea was to get Anthony Michael Hall for Cameron. Oh, I forget. Someone else for... Someone else for Ferris.
Oh, okay. I don't know. I just remember Anthony Michael Hall was certainly offered a role in Ferris. It might not have been Ferris. It might have been Cameron. That would probably make more sense.
I think that was it.
Anthony Michael Hall was just adamant about not doing these teen movies anymore and trying to break away from Hughes. His parents, who were his management, tried to convince him for like 4 hours to take this role and stuff like that. And just not happening.
And again, this is kind of one of those things that comes up with every really popular movie, but there's always rumors of, like, a Ferris Bueller sequel. What do you think of that idea?
Oh, it's not going to happen.
No, it's absolutely not, definitively, but...
I always thought it seemed like something... until John Hughes dies, I always thought it was something that was still possible.
Yeah? And you think it would have been good?
I think it absolutely could have been good.
Yeah. Because I guess...
Could have been the ultimate Hughes comes back to his sort of like to reassess the people he left behind in the 80s, you know, like,
yeah,
so like see where they are now and what he thinks of them now and stuff like that.
Yeah, they had some ideas where it's like it'd be his first day of college and he takes, or like he's another day in college and he chooses to take off, or like he's got a job and he chooses to take a day off.
No, I always, felt like a post 2000 Ferris Bueller sequel would be the most interesting.
That'd be cool.
Yeah. That was what I was talking about. You know.
Okay. Yeah. And one Matthew Broderick suggested, said like, wait till we get 70 where Cameron, he's not actually sick, but he moves into a retirement home cause he thinks he needs to.
Yeah.
So, Ferris comes and saves him and like takes him to a strip club and more crazy things happen, of course.
Yeah. I think the suggestion was that he dies at the strip club.
He's supposed to die at the end, right? Yeah. What else do you have to say about Ferris Bueller's Day Off?
In Pretty in Pink, Breakfast Club, and 16 Candles, he was sort of like giving us a look at teenage life. We're sort of seeing how he sees teenagers, and that in turn, which by all accounts was how teenagers were at the time, and kind of still is how they are, at least to my recollection. And then, you know, he's sort of setting out all these sort of types of teenagers, particularly in the Breakfast Club. And, but it's all sort of, you know, it's fairly explicit, but there's never really, and there's some fourth wall breaking in Pretty in Pink and 16 Candles. But, Ferris Bueller really takes it up a whole another level in that Ferris Bueller is often seen addressing the camera directly.
Yeah.
And Ferris Bueller is also sort of like this, a type of philosophical character. He's not, he's not reading Descartes to us, you know, or anything, but he is spouting out life philosophies, most notably the one that is repeated and the one that everybody remembers and is probably in your high school yearbook somewhere, which is life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop to take a look around, you could miss it. Which, you know, I might not be getting word for word, but probably pretty close. And that's sort of what we leave the movie on. And I sort of look at Ferris Bueller as, and since this is the last teen movie, that John Hughes would direct, he wrote Some Kind of Wonderful, but was also apparently very hands-off on that production. He just sort of wrote it and would show up on set sometimes, but that was about it. And Ferris Bueller was the last time he would shoot inside of a high school or shoot a high school character. And it's sort of like he set out how we see these high school characters, and now he's telling them to sort of how to live their life from now on. You know, he's giving them suggestions as to how to go on. You know, like, I think he's sort of like, he knows he's not going to continue this on, and like, he's got his foot out the door, and who knows, maybe if Ducky ends up with Andy and Pretty in Pink, he never writes Some Kind of Wonderful, you know? And Ferris Bueller is very much about moving on. Like, it's all about having one last great time before you graduate, and, you know, what's a better time in the movies than Ferris Bueller? And then he sort of graduates from teen movies as Ferris, Cameron, and, well, not Sloan, she's a year younger, graduate from high school. And that's sort of why what I really like about the movie and why I think it's so interesting is that Ferris, it seems totally in control at all times, but he's not. He's really worried about his future. And I think that's valid. You know, he's legitimately worried about him and Cameron no longer being friends, which I think is extremely realistic for a teen movie and really cool because, you know, how are you not worried about that, especially if you go to different colleges? And that's why I sort of see the Sloan character, played by Mia Sara, as sort of more important than people generally give her credit. I think she's great in the movie. She's extremely beautiful and extremely graceful. But what she is the one thing that Ferris knows will happen. Throughout the movie, we get a couple references to him saying, I'm going to marry you. And the last thing she says is, he's going to marry me, which is like, she knows this is going to happen. They're going to be together. And what she is sort of like the embodiment of hope, you know, like she's not like this really fully formed character, but just in her, if only in her physical appearance and the way she sort of moves, like she is very graceful and she's got those Disney eyes. So she looks very hopeful at all times. And you can sort of see that in Andrew McCarthy's eyes a little bit with Andy ending up with him at the end of Pretty in Pink. But yeah, Mia Sara plays sort of the hope for the future. John Hughes hopes everything works out for all these characters. And this is the one thing that we know is going to be a constant in Ferris's life going on. And yeah, she represents hope and that she's so, you know, she looks so hopeful. And, you know, it's Hughes's sort of hope that his audience will continue on and enjoy their lives even without him.
Okay. Yeah. I know I saw an interview with Matthew Broderick kind of to one of the points you said where they asked him about the sequel and he said in some way there is no sequel to this movie because it's not just about Ferris. It's about that time in your life. It's about that last week before you leave school and like there is no sequel to that because that's one moment that just, I mean, you don't get to repeat that. That you're absolutely right. That is such an important part of the movie of just the time frame of it and how it's about one thing ending and a totally different thing starting. And yeah, as calm and cool as he is, you do see he is giving this concern to his future.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think how much did John Hughes hate getting older, do you think? Like, do you think he just despised it considering of how much he's known for this, like, kind of 14 to 17-year-old, I guess like 15 to 18 maybe, but...
Yeah. I don't know. I think you maybe until he had... Maybe until he had kids, because you can sort of see, you know, even his movies sort of keep following his life. Even as he's writing into the 90s, he's just sort of known for kids movies, writing kids movies at that point.
Yeah, he stopped directing in 91, but he wrote tons more movies.
Yeah. And they all sort of follow his kids' lives, like what his kids would be interested in.
Yeah.
And so I think it's sort of, I don't know that he ever, he just didn't know anything else to write until he had kids, which is what she's having a baby or whatever is sort of about, presumably. And
that's safe to say.
Yeah. And then once, you know, he started writing like Baby's Day Out and stuff like that and Home Alone, and it's very kid friendly movies. And yeah, I think he just always wrote for youth. Like that's sort of.
Okay.
You know, who wouldn't want to stay young their whole life, you know? Like,
yeah. Yeah. So yeah, just to get back to the music thing for how important it was to John Hughes, as we just said, he kept writing his whole life, even when he stopped writing scripts that he was submitting to Hollywood, like gems like Drillbit Taylor.
He didn't write that script. That was a story idea.
He always wrote. A lot of the stuff, apparently, his family has said he just has tons and tons of stuff just at home, just written on computer, written on notepads, things like that. Writing stayed important to him, and music stayed important to him. I know for his son's wedding, he made like an iPod and like carefully loaded up the playlist for his son's wedding. Exactly like he wanted it to be. And near the end of his life, he was still just filling up. He'd buy a bunch of iPods and fill it up with his favorite music for certain people and just give it out. And that was something he did back with mixtapes in the 80s, where he'd give them to Molly Ringwald and Anthony Michael Hall and stuff like that. And I know the other kind of sad story is John Candy's son got like a 4-gig iPod from him, just filled with all his all John Hughes' favorite music, or what John Hughes thought John Candy's son would like. And he loved it, and he would listen to it all the time. And then when John Hughes dies, it obviously hit him pretty hard. And at this point, he had a radio station at the college he was attending. So what he did is he just put the iPod on shuffle and just kind of let it play for like 24 hours. Mm-hmm. And that was his little John Hughes tribute. And then when they had their funeral, he lent that iPod back to the Hughes family, and they played that as like background music for a funeral. I mean, it's cute, but I don't know. Bunch of 80s music playing at your funeral.
Well, just to say it was still into 80s music, you know?
Oh, yeah, that's true. I guess I kind of just assumed that. Yeah. But yeah, he died August 6, 2009. Yeah. And again, like, tons of people came out to say how influential he was and how important he was. Mm-hmm. Judd Apatow said that, like, he couldn't imagine what his life would be like without John Hughes. He said John Hughes made him laugh harder and more often than anybody else ever has. And he said, Judd Apatow said, "All I do is make John Hughes movies with swear words."
That's what Kevin Smith says as well.
Yeah. And it's just like these personal relationships. It's like, you know, really dialogue heavy, character driven stories, being kind of really vulnerable and revealing, and, you know, adding swear words to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. He had a couple ideas still, like, that he planned on writing a script for at some point, and I don't know if he just gave up or he just never found the time to do it. But there is one, have you heard of any of these?
No.
Bartholomew versus Neff.
Okay.
Which is Sylvester Stallone and John Candy as feuding neighbors.
Nice.
Which would be awesome. The Grisbys Go Broke, which is about a wealthy family who loses all their money during Christmas time and has to move to like the wrong side of the tracks. Which to me sounds a lot like a Hughes movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of like the class struggle again and the holidays and stuff like that.
Are we sure that didn't turn into For Richer or For Poorer with Tim Allen and Kirstie Alley?
No, I don't know that for a fact. There's one called Tickets. A bunch of teens wait overnight for free tickets to a farewell concert to the band. Again, like insanely Hughes plot line that sounds like music, teenagers,
line
farewell
up
concerts. Probably like a bottle episode, pretty much bottle movie. And Oil and Vinegar, which I think takes the cake for like
I've heard about this
the
one.
Most used one. Some engaged man like on like trying to drive to the town where his wedding is going to be, picks up this younger teenage female hitchhiker, and then they talk about their lives, and I'm guessing by the end he probably doesn't go to the wedding. But
that one actually got pretty close to being made. Molly Ringwald and Matthew Broderick were going to be those two characters, and schedules just sort of didn't work out, and then after a while it just sort of fell by the wayside. But yeah,
that's too bad.
Yeah,
yeah. And I know he wrote all the way to the end of his life, and I'll try to put the link up on the website, but I mean, it's still funny, the stuff he's writing, but a lot of it's kind of dark comedy and has a pretty bitter tone to it.
No.
And I know there's one of he's writing from the viewpoint of a middle-aged woman who keeps a diary, and you know, she goes to a coffee shop and it's all young customers and young employees and stuff, and she kind of diarizes her whole life and everything she sees. And one thing she writes is I think one of the first lines is, "I feel like a fucking court stenographer. Why do I have to, you know, write down all these details about these, you know, stupid kids and all this kind of stuff?" And I don't know, it just, I don't know if that's him kind of growing bitter towards today's youth, or if that's him doing as he normally does and depicting adults as these people who just kind of hate children, right?
Well, he was really, I don't know, Hollywood kind of, he didn't mesh well with Hollywood. I mean, clearly he left. But by, you know, by the 90s, people hated working with him. And there was sort of like a saying around Hollywood that the second his movies stopped making money, people will run away faster than you could even imagine from him. Because he was just a terrible person to work with by the end of things, apparently. And would just freak out. And I mean, like when you were done with John Hughes, you were done. Like, you know, some guy who was part of the soundtrack for, I think, Up to Pretty in Pink. He was going to do the soundtrack on Ferris Bueller as well. And he's like, oh, I've got this song by The Cure, but John Hughes wanted him to only do soundtracks for him. And he's like, no, I can't do that. I've got this other one going. And he's like, oh, okay. And I'm done. And they never talked again. You know, like, it's just, he was a very temperamental person. He was like a teenager. So
he and Molly Ringwald had a pretty public falling out too, right?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, they had some things were said publicly. I don't know that was a public falling out. You know, it was just sort of things that were said that could have easily been remedied, but just didn't. You know, it happens all the time. Yeah, so in watching these movies again, I've seen most of them. Well, yeah, I've seen all of them a number of times. And I just sort of, I remembered all the iconic moments. And I never loved any of these movies other than Ferris Bueller. And I still don't. I still think they are decent to good movies. I don't think there's anything about them other than, you know, what I find them very interesting. And I think there are elements that are really interesting. But I find that the iconic moments in the movies always ended up being sort of underwhelming because these are movies with such great moments that are often surrounded by parts that are just really mediocre. And I think sort of, you know, like watching Ducky's dance out of context, you know, makes it even more fun than just watching the first 35 minutes of the movie to get to it and, you know, the hour afterwards. And that's the case in pretty much everything, including Ferris Bueller. Like the build up to the parade scene isn't great, but the parade scene is spectacular. And it's just all of these movies are just filled with all these great moments, like even the ones care for, but there are these moments of Ducky dancing and Ducky crying in the rain, you know, with that giant mural behind him, which I pointed out. You know, all these movies all have their iconic moments, like Judd Nelson thrusting his fist in the air. And these moments mean so much to the people that saw the movies when they came out or saw the movies when they were growing up as teenagers. And it's almost like the movies are underwhelming now because the moments in them are so good. And it's these moments that stick with people and these moments from these specific Hughes movies that leads Hughes to stick with people. And that's why there was such an outpouring of grief when Hughes died. Like, I saw so much stuff on the internet when he died. And I mean, Molly Ringwald's op-ed piece in the New York Times and just all throughout Hollywood, you saw people sort of, you know, giving their statements and stuff like that. But what seems to matter most about Hughes' legacy is not the movies themselves, but the way people remember these movies and the way people remember these moments and how these moments have attached themselves to their own lives. When we're remembering Hughes movies and people that love these movies, when they're remembering them, they aren't necessarily remembering the movies. They're remembering these parts attached to their lives and what they meant to them. And I recognize that that's a blanket statement for film in general, like films that really stick with you and art and music as well. But it seems like these movies more than any other sort of group of movies have sort of resonated with a very youthful audience, which is when things sort of stick with you the most. And I think Hughes' legacy is sort of outside of film, which is possibly the most impressive type of legacy to have. He's being remembered for being a filmmaker, yeah, but people are remembering him for the way they frame their lives around him. And I think that's really interesting. And I mean, how many filmmakers can say that, you know?
No, not a lot.
So yeah, I mean, other than Ferris Bueller, I don't love any of these movies, but good work.
Yeah, and it's just because it's such a like an influential time in your life where we've talked before about how movies that you see, you know, growing up are always going to be good to you. And yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's just it's more the moments and the emotions that the people gain from them while watching them than, you know, oh, the structure of this movie is great and the pacing is phenomenal. It's the very isolated moments that meant a lot to the people while they watched them. And it just put them in the rank of, you know, the feeling that you had, you know, on like a first date or your, you know, like a first kiss or something. It gets away from it, kind of, as you said, it transcends film and just skips over that medium and right into the things that are, you know, the closest to your heart growing up.
So yeah, thank you for listening. And be sure to check us out next week. So, yeah, thanks again.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. This episode has been brought to you by Glen Coco. Aw, you're sponsoring episodes now? Good for you, Glen Coco. You go, Glen Coco. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.